You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of February 2017 on Monocle 24. Live from London, this is Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, coming up.
Does the National Security Advisor right now enjoy the full confidence of President Trump?
Yes, General Flynn does enjoy the full confidence of the president.
Well, 7 hours later, and the US National Security Advisor was out. We'll assess the fallout left by Michael Flynn's short and stormy tenure. Also ahead, a peek inside the Turkish president's diplomacy notebook as he tours Saudi Arabia. Plus,
I have very strong theories about magazine publishing, and I think that a magazine is an old friend. So what you try to create with the publication is a sense of a friend visiting with something new.
Well, the House of Hefner puts nude back on the pages of Playboy. And before you pop a cork in celebration or not, brace yourself. Champagne prices are going up too. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, welcome to Midori House. It would help if I could say champagne. It sounded as though I'd been on a bottle or two of it already. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, specialising in US interventions around the world, and Jeffrey Kaufman, Emmy Award-winning veteran network television news and war correspondent. Welcome both to the programme. Michael Flynn's rise to US National Security Advisor was always going to raise eyebrows. His friendliness with Russia made him a controversial pick, but even those who disapproved of the nomination might have been surprised by the stormy terms of his exit last night. But while General Flynn no longer plays a role in American foreign policy, questions over the Trump administration's relationship with the Kremlin will remain. Let's start with you, Jeffrey. You know, what do you think Mr. Trump makes of the last few days?
I think Trump has no understanding of the word accountability, and so for him this is all we're watching a man learn on the job. How he responds, we can only guess. I think the difficulty I have in talking around this table about Donald Trump is that we live in this universe of two solitudes. Those of us who think, what is going on? How did this man get to the White House? And the people who believe this is a good thing. And I think that the question that the Flynn resignation for me raises is not what does Donald Trump think, but what do the Trump supporters think? And at what point, is there a tipping point at which they say, oh my God, what have we got ourselves into? This guy is so out of his depth, and the world is really in peril with Donald Trump in the White House. Is this the point? Clearly not. But how many of these do we need?
But Jeffrey, don't you think that if you were a big Trump supporter, you'd just say he was let down rather than it was his failure? You would think, here's a man who is unable to kind of tell the truth.
Flynn has a long history of inappropriate relationships with Russia that he did not report as he was meant to. I mean, he broke the law when he appeared at a Russia Today banquet in Moscow at their expense, did not, as a general, acknowledge that it was paid for. I mean, this is a guy who's had a number of dealings where he has shown bad judgment with relation to Russia, and that should have set off alarms before he was given this job.
Kathleen, we know that as early as the beginning of January, people were warning the Trump administration that here was a man who could be blackmailed because he had such close relations with the Russians. And there was a sense that he wasn't quite telling the truth about the nature of his contact. Why do you think they've been so slow to get rid of him?
Well, the first question I have about Flynn is, how could he be so terminally stupid? A man who is the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, obviously it never occurred to him that they might wiretap any conversations, especially that of Russian diplomats. I remain rather knocked over by that, I must say. You have to get, how do I say this delicately?
Oh, don't be delicate.
Well, I've almost forgotten what Andrew asked me. But the striking thing about Russian-American relations is they hate each other and they have to get along. So therefore, what you need is adaptability and the ability to sort of move over in the harbor so the other ship can be there as well without firing on each other. This is probably best done by people who are used to adapting and juggling, except that too much adaptability allows the other one to get in charge. Now, the problem is Trump has gotten rid of, as far as I can tell, and over here in London and not on the network, I don't exactly know how many, but an awful lot of the State Department has walked out. Now, does this include Russian specialists? If so, who will be able to grade, I don't mean grade like giving grades, but who will be able to determine to what extent it is safe doing what one is doing and when you actually are threatening to go over the line.
But Kathleen, the point you were a bit of a politician there. You dodged my initial question. But the question I was keen to know was, why were they so slow to get rid of him? They knew weeks ago that he was potentially a danger, a risk. Why were they so slow? Even yesterday, Kellyanne Conway saying, fine, we're going to stand by our man. Why were they so slow to react? Do you think that in the end, you get the sense that they didn't really care about what he'd done? They just cared once the public really found out.
Well, I did sort of wonder whether, until Trump made up his mind, it was very dangerous for any of subordinates to take firm line on either one or the other. Until he had told Kellyanne Conway, he's out. They'd gone as far as saying that Trump was evaluating, but the point is he made something of a splash nationally. It is when he spoke at the coronation of Trump. He was supposed to be rough and tough and not being pushed over by the State Department and so forth. So to lose. The question is, did Trump think he could be controlled? The second question is, was Trump made aware of just how dodgy the man was, or were people afraid that this close comrade was going to be saved no matter what, and it would put them in the wrong position?
I think, Andrew, your question assumes a kind of logic and order that I don't believe exists in the Trump White House. I don't think this is not a proactive leadership. This is a reactive. And I think this is a Donald Trump who, throughout his lifetime, throughout the campaign, look at all the missteps he got away with. This is a man who could say the most outrageous things, and people still voted for him. He still won the nomination, etc. He has never had to really explain. Now he suddenly is in this place of power, of extraordinary power. And he has no vocabulary for this kind of anticipation and organization that is required in the job. And so, of course, he wouldn't plan. And of course, Kellyanne Conway would go publicly on the airwaves on Sunday and say, Flynn's fine. And in fact, the NSC didn't even know that he had resigned. His own agency had not been briefed when the resignation was announced.
Two found it in the press, didn't they?
Yeah, so, I mean, this suggests that what you see is what there is, which is when you scratch the surface, you get more surface.
Could I? That was rather nice. I like that.
Thank you.
I think one has to notice that Trump is saying much less bombastic things nowadays than he did. I think, in fact, what the presidency is finally beginning to dawn on him. He may not be able to speak well, but the fact that he's not speaking at all for a while has got to be an advantage.
Well, as a Canadian, I watched with interest the awkward meeting yesterday of Justin Trudeau and Trump, two men of just polar opposite ideologies. And to their credit, they managed to accommodate one another's differences without actually being obnoxious. And Trudeau nicely danced around the notion that he didn't come to the United States to tell Americans how they should govern their country. Trump, in a kind of clumsy way, said, no, NAFTA is really about those bad hombres in Mexico. You Canadians, we might tweak it a bit. But I think Trump, after that horrific episode with the Australian prime minister, has at least must be a little bit chastened about the way he performs on the diplomatic front.
It's interesting that you mentioned the Canadians, because both, all these stories, you have a sense of not knowing quite where Trump stands. So we know that he and Trudeau couldn't be more diametrically opposed, yet they managed to kind of get on. He's hit out at China consistently, perhaps now realizes he needs China's help. So he says, oh, yes, I'm definitely going to back the one China policy. You know, he's even gone a little bit quieter on what's happening in Mexico. He has failed to get through his so-called Muslim ban. And again, it's very difficult for anybody who's watching all of these episodes to unfold, even his relationship with Russia, to know exactly where he stands on any issue.
I don't think there is a stand. I don't think anybody had ever asked him to consider Canada's relationship to NAFTA. He sees low-wage jobs in Mexico taking away air conditioning manufacturing and auto manufacturing from Americans. The fact is that, you know, Canada is inextricably linked through the North American Free Trade Act and prior to that the Auto Pact with the U.S. economy. Those are high-paying jobs. They're competitive with the U.S. The parts go from Canada to the U.S., the U.S. to Canada. It's considered a very successful trade arrangement. I think it's fair to say that Donald Trump had probably, prior to that question and maybe a quick briefing, never considered that equation when he talked about the bad hombres in Mexico.
Kathleen, can I ask you, I think Jeffrey made an interesting point. You know, for critics of Trump, they wonder, you know, the wheels are coming off. When are people going to change their minds? But for supporters of Trump, I wonder if we're going to get through this presidency with, you know, roughly equal numbers supporting and opposing him as there are now, right until the very end, because he does seem to be somebody who, you know, can do no wrong in the eyes of his supporters. And it's hard to see after all the kind of supposed slips that he could really put a foot wrong now. Do you think that we, you know, liberals or people who are critics of Trump are wasting their breath getting too excited about, you know, looking for this moment of change, because it's not going to happen in 4 years?
I mean, what Trump has done well is to set up a context in which anytime something goes wrong, it's not him, it's Washington. That is to say, here I am, the heroic Trump, trying to get this done on your behalf as I told you I would. And the bad hombres in Washington, the establishment, are stopping me from doing it. So in that sense, he can keep his halo whilst not accomplishing very much, because he has a ready-made scapegoat. I cannot believe that there's not going to be some little bit of shift, because Trump supporters had different reasons for supporting him, and they had different layers of support. And it's already clear that in some areas, it's starting to break up a little. So I don't think we will be on the same point on the scale at the end of 4 years as we are now.
Jeffrey, you wanted to dive in?
Yeah, I think I learned after having said on these airways the night before the American election that Hillary Clinton would win, I have retired permanently my hat as a prognosticator. I just want to eat my crow in public. But so having said that, I think it really is fair to, as a prognosticator, to say that anything is possible. Trump could be gone within a year. He could be reelected, and he could be president for 8 years. I think this is such we are in such uncharted waters. It's hard to imagine the Republicans, who have made this Faustian deal in order to attain and sustain power, turning on him. It's really hard when you think, no matter what he does, if they turn on him, Trump's supporters or some of their base would turn on them. And therefore, it has to be so extreme for him to even possibly face impeachment, at least prior to the midterms in 2 years, that it seems that he's got at least a 2-year window. If the Democrats can capture the House, which is very numerically very hard, perhaps the equation changes a little bit. But I just think that anything is possible. This is a man who controls the nuclear codes. This is a man with a temper. And he is talking about North Korea. He is talking about China. He is talking about Iran, countries that are unpredictable. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that even they don't know what to do right now. They're holding their breath because they want to see what's going to happen. But let's be clear. The old rules are gone.
We are preparing for a run up to the midterms.
Already?
Yeah, we are. But to be honest, the campaign for re-election of president kind of begins the day after the last one finishes. It is 2 years off. But Jeffrey is saying he doesn't see that they could recapture the House. But if he's going to be so divisive and so complicated, why do you think, again, it comes back to this point, why do we think that there could not be the kind of reversal of fortune that would cause him real pain in 2 years?
You mean like happened to Obama?
Yes.
Because people think that no one is as good as the Tea Party, I suspect. What the sort of insurgent part of the Democratic Party are doing now, as we all know, has taken a leaf out of the Tea Party book and actually not just go on the odd demonstration to spend your Saturdays building the local party. So that's what the Republicans did. If the Democrats can do that enough, there's an opportunity. The drawback, as we all know, is the gerrymandering.
Exactly, you're reading my mind.
Yeah. I didn't even have to do that.
Yeah.
Have my own mind. In fact, if you have bacon-shaped constituencies, which are creatively constructed to maximize the Republican vote, shall we say, it's going to be very difficult to overturn those. Something probably unfortunate will have to happen to sweep everything away, but I think there will be incremental because the Congress virtually always changes in the opposite party from the one that's in the White House at midterms. It would be astonishing if there wasn't some of that.
Well, you can be sure of this. The party, the celebrations, the hatred, the anger, all of these emotions are going to be on display for a few more years yet. But next, the president of Turkey is on tour in the Gulf as part of a diplomatic mission to strengthen ties in the region. Since King Salman of Saudi Arabia ascended the throne in 2015, the two nations have repaired relations following the 2013 ousting of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. Regional stability, business and security will all be on the agenda. But Turkey's increasing grip on freedom of expression and its clamping down on the media won't be up for discussion, we think. Well, what's Erdogan up to here? He's trying to make friends in the region. Does he feel he's short of friends if he heads west into Europe? Does he need to have more friends in the Middle East and Arab world, do you think, Kathleen?
Well, I mean, he has had a push for ever since he came into power to turn Turkey back into a major power in the Middle East. Now, to do that, he can't do it by himself. For one thing, he's now securing his borders, the border with Saudi Arabia, the border he hopes without Kurds with Syria, a Syria that he can live with. So on one hand, that's commoner garden power politics. You make sure... Forgive me. You make sure your borders are secure. Secondly, of course, there are two Sunni powers. And the crucial thing for Saudi Arabia and incomingly, possibly, for Turkey is the fact that Iran is growing much more as a regional power. And Iran is a Shia power. In other words, the breakdown in the Middle East between Sunni and Shia is the breakdown between Erdogan and King Salman in Saudi Arabia and Iran. So he's building his power block. He's doing it by securing geography and indeed in terms of who can fly from his airfields in Incirlik, and getting, if you notice where the Gulf states are, he's trying in a funny sort of way to surround Iran with his own clients. So he's made such an appalling mess of a foreign policy over the past 10 years that he's obviously picking himself up and starting again.
Jeffrey, what's interesting is the Saudis obviously wanted during the Syrian civil war to play a part of influencing against Iran and therefore effectively against Russia and against the regime. And they had much in common with Turkey. But Turkey has now kind of made a bit of a peace deal with the Russians. It's kind of edged away from...
Try to say that in a 140-character tweet.
Okay. It's kind of edged away from its confrontation with the Assad regime. It's kind of ignoring what the Iranians do. They've divided up the country a little bit. Doesn't that make it a little bit more complicated for Turkey and Saudi Arabia to get on, don't you think? Because in the end, one of them is willing to kind of accept the status quo a little bit more, and the other one still doesn't. The Saudis really do not like what's happening.
Well, I think that Kathleen's right. I think that you see the Sunni alliance against the Shiite power base, and I think that just because I don't think in global politics, because it matters that one alliance contradicts another alliance. I think these become alliances of convenience, and Erdogan is clearly trying to grab power. The interesting thing about Erdogan is I remember when I was in Libya covering the fall of Gaddafi, and people said, democracy, it's coming to the Arab world, it's going to flower here. And I remember saying to people, so where's the model for this? Where are you going to look to learn how to do this? And they said, you know, Turkey. Turkey's going to you know, is our model. And look what's happened to Turkey. I mean, you know, the one shining example of burgeoning democracy in the Muslim world is now in peril under an authoritarian. I think this is an opportunist. I guess we've just been talking about an opportunist in the White House. We are in an era of opportunist leadership.
Well, we're going to move on shortly, but you're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Kathleen Burke and Geoffrey Kaufman. Because coming up next, those planning to toast to Britain, leaving the European Union, may not start saving their pennies. Prices for champagne are going up. Stay tuned.
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Istanbul, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, this is Midori House. I'm Andrew Tuck, and still with me are Kathleen Burke and Geoffrey Kaufman. If you're partial to a glass of bubbly, you might like to start putting away some pennies. Britain's drinks industry warns that the effects of Brexit may soon push up the price of champagne. Whatever next? Well, the Wine and Spirit Trade Association warns that higher inflation, the impact of the pound's devaluation, and the potential for duty increases could prove troubling for the wine sellers over the next 12 months. Kathleen, this is the ultimate liberal worry story, isn't it? I think that, you know, a few pence on the price of a glass of champagne is hardly going to be really worry the majority of people in this country.
Well, it's likely to go up 28% this year. I mean, the point is that it's been falling. Champagne imports last year went down 13%. Bordeaux imports went down 26%. So this isn't a new, exciting and view. I mean, my answer would be forget champagne and go after British sparkling. There are a dozen producers in this country that make spectacularly good wine. If you must have champagne, don't go after the big brands that we all know, because they are able to add what they want. Go after what's called growers' champagne. All these small producers that used to just sell their grapes to the big brands, you know, the Veuve Clicquot, the Mumms, the Krugs, and so forth, are now making their own. But stick to your last have one of the dozen British ones. They are winning international awards against champagne.
Geoffrey, what would your advice be? Well, I think my advice might be move to France, because
if you have a British passport, yeah, you may not be able to stay long.
Well, you just need to find a French person. £2.67 is the amount of duty added to the price of a bottle of champagne in the UK. 6 pence in France. You could have champagne for breakfast every day.
It is outrageous. I wonder, though, Andrew, whether these little things, which obviously are just diversions and of no consequence really, are the beginning of what we're going to see as Brexit seems now to be becoming an inevitability. Are there bigger costs that are going to start to hit people in the pocket that will make them reconsider whether this wasn't really a good idea? For those who can afford to travel, you know, the European health card means that a person with a British passport can have a traffic accident in Germany or in Spain and get medical coverage at no cost. That disappears when the EU, when with Brexit. All sorts of trade consequences and employment consequences, mobility consequences, are yet to be explained. You know, this is what I find so exasperating and befuddling about Brexit means Brexit is that no one knows what Brexit means. And you know, this is obviously a nothing, but it does raise the question. So it's just exactly what will be the real meaning of Brexit 5 years from now?
Of course, it's not a little thing if you're a wine merchant or corner shop or whatever in Britain. I mean, I agree with everything that Geoffrey has said. But there are a lot of livelihood dependent on production and export of wine. In fact, and although my heart does not bleed for champagne drinkers, because I rather prefer light wine, as it were, and though it's a small thing compared, I suppose, to the export of cars, nevertheless, as the daughter of a grape farmer, I feel I must stand up here and say there's a whole agricultural and productive community in both countries that are going to get hit.
Well, in this kind of Trumpian world, I'm sure that as prices go up, they'll just say, well, it's, you know, it's the French's fault, it's, you know, someone else's fault. There's going to be no acceptance of responsibility. But I wonder, Geoffrey, also, some of these people, you know, who voted for Brexit, many people who are supportive of Brexit, they kind of said, well, do you know what, I don't mind paying a bit more as long as I kind of get my, you know, rights to decide my own laws and kick out foreigners.
And they're completely entitled to that ideology and that view. And they may be right. You know, we don't know. There are a lot of intelligent people on both sides of this debate. It's confusing to, amidst all the rhetoric and all the half-truths of that Brexit campaign last spring, to know just what the reality is going to be. And I, you know, I go back to the point that, you know, people voted for something and they don't. You ask 10 people who voted for Brexit what Brexit means, and you'd get 10 very different answers, which are irreconcilable. And I think that's where it becomes interesting in the coming years.
Well, finally, tonight, I think this is a kind of Valentine's theme. We've had the champagne, but it's now definitely time to get your clothes off, because finally tonight, well, not here in the studio, I might point out, finally tonight for readers of Playboy magazine, it seems that everything old is nude again. Just 1 year after the classic men's magazine announced that it would stop publishing naked photography, the title is stripping back to its bare essentials. Cooper Hefner, a son of Playboy founder Hugh Hefner, says that despite the dated nature of the magazine's old draw card, removing nudity from the pages was a mistake. The new issue features a naked woman on the cover, wearing only the magazine's headline, Naked is Normal. And Kathleen's putting up her hand here. I'm not sure
Kathleen,
what she's,
over to you.
I'm not sure what she's volunteering yeah. for, but I'm hoping we're safe.
Please talk. Can you talk to the end of the show, please?
If you be quiet, yes.
Go for it.
Well, it's... When I was in my hot youth and a lot of my friends read Playboy, I was given to understand it was because of the quality of the articles. Nowadays, of course, we have a scientific test in front of us that once they put the naked ladies on the front, will their subscription rates go up? That is to say, will more and more people buy it? If so, we will know it's not the quality of the articles, it's the naked flesh. I figure every man... is on...
I kind of think so. So first of all, I'm going to put my hand up and say I think in the 60s and 70s there was a lot of very good journalism in Playboy. But the thing is, I can't... The interesting thing about, you know, a naked woman on a piece of paper, you just have to click online and you can
exactly.
see what every single thing you want. So I can't believe that it's that big a draw card for selling magazines. And when you think here in the UK... All the likes of these magazines like Nuts and things, which were, you know, very successful at a point, just as the internet was taking off at kind of selling nudity, they've all kind of vanished. Porn has become a completely online thing. And this kind of quiet world of titillation, I can't believe... Do you think, Geoffrey...
But why is he putting it back on?
Oh, I think it's very... I think it's very simple. I think he's on the verge of going into the dustbins of history.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think that this is a sign
QED.
That they're losing their market. They made a tactical error. They think that undermined. Clearly, circulation is down. Andrew, you edit a magazine. You wouldn't go back on a decision a year later if it wasn't affecting circulation dramatically, would you?
Yeah, I think we've had like the odd naked person in the issue. I think there was
a naked
old man in a sauna at one point. I don't know if that put on any. any sales whatsoever.
This is the end of Playboy. I think that, you know, let's revisit this in a year or two and see whether.
But Kathleen, in a world when there's like monstrous things online, isn't a gentle bit of titillation neither here nor there these days? And interestingly, I think. You know, lots of women take very different viewpoints than they did many years ago. Some people are completely indifferent to it. Some people hate it, of course. But, you know, is it so bad?
I mean, I'm
he
in
leaves
the...
himself over here for many calls, I think.
Not at all. I'm in the I so don't care category. If it's not illegal and people take pleasure in it, fine. If they want to pay for that sort of thing that, as you've pointed out, you can get free on the internet, just print it out yourself, fine. Maybe it's the glossiness that turns them on.
I think what's incredible about Playboy is how you know, it seemed so risque. And listen, I'm talking as a gay man. This was not my thing. But it, to be clear, but it seemed so risque when my brother brought it home. And, you know, now it just seems so absurdly innocent to think that Playboy's discreetly covered women are somehow too much.
Well, I don't know. I don't think I was a big reader of it either. But there you go.
Admissions.
You know, I've read some other things. Anyway, that's all we have time for, though, on today's Midori House, before any of us get in more trouble. Kathleen Burke and Jeffrey Kaufman, thank you very much for joining us. Today's show, it was produced by Ben Ryland, who kept his clothes on throughout. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. I'm not sure if he did. And Tom Furs. And our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. I think he's got a story or two to tell. More music next. Then at 1900 hours, it's Monocle's Design Show, Section D. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, fully clothed, ready for a glass of champagne. Yeah, we're ready. Goodbye.
You warned me. I could have brought some along.
Thank you.